Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Hey, it's time to take a look at the world of wildlife in Wisconsin. Lots going on. And Scott Craven, our wildlife ecologist, with me in the studio today to talk with you about those things. And I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've seen some cool, have some cool wildlife sightings. Maybe have some wildlife questions. Join in at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or post a question and or photo. I'd love to see those wildlife photos as well on our Facebook page. The Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show, and just go there and you can post in. And Scott Craven, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Oh, it's good to be here, Larry.
The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is conducting a 10-year Priorities for Fish, Wildlife, and Habitat Management in Wisconsin survey. That's a mouthful. What do they hope to learn?
Well, the upshot is that two big plans, the Wisconsin Wildlife Action Plan and the Long-Term Plan for Fish, Wildlife, and Habitat Management, are both up for revision and updating. And they've tried a couple of different tactics to get public input. One that I attended about a week and a half ago or so were called Conservation Cafes, that were held throughout the state. In fact, I think some are still being held if anybody sees one in their community. I really enjoyed it. It was an open discussion format, a small table format with a lot of DNR folks there. So a few of us sat around the table and talked about what the agency's doing well, where they're having problems, you know, what are the priorities for the future. And that feedback goes into the revisions of these plans. So that was kind of a neat thing.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it was, you know, I think the fact is it takes some controversy to bring people out. So if we'd been talking about ending the deer season, there'd been 9,000 people there, but yeah, there were far less than that. But the biggest or easiest way for people to have input, and I think Judith got a link up on your Facebook page.
Yes, we
this.
Do have that.
Or you can just go to the DNR website and search WAP, W-A-P, the Wildlife Action Plan. It will take you to the survey link. That survey link is active until Friday the 14th, so about a week and a half. And there's a 5 or 10 minute survey there to get people's feedback on these plans. Now, the plans are also, the whole plan is available to read. Both of them are in the 100-page range, but
some summaries.
It's a complete, there are good summaries, but reading the plan is just a complete review of everything that's going on in the state for virtually every species and every habitat that they live in.
That's great.
So it's a good educational opportunity. It's a good review if you think you know something about these things, and then you can provide the feedback. So It's a neat opportunity, and it doesn't come around very often.
I think it's really wonderful. It's a chance pretty easily to get your input.
Yes, certainly the online survey, and if there are still some conservation cafes active, then that was kind of a fun way to do it too.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, we've got lots of other things we're to talk about today. I know Dan Small is probably going to be joining us in a little bit, and we can talk with him a little about his deer hunt program, but we're heading into the gun deer season in just a couple of weeks, and we've got a pretty good forecast, haven't we, for deer numbers?
Yes, the upcoming season looks pretty good, as it has for, you know, as you go back many years. It's always looked pretty promising. There are some I think the real issue this year is not necessarily deer numbers or deer distribution as much as it is folks taking the time to get used to all of the rules and regulations changes.
Yeah.
New terminology for the management units, different registration scenarios for some people, different tags, private public land tags, tags by county, tags by farmland or forest zone, no antlerless harvest in a considerable chunk of the North Woods. Lots of things that folks who are thinking about going afield in a couple weeks need to pay some attention to before they hit the field.
Dave in Wisconsin Rapids has a question, so let's go there. Dave, hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry, and good morning, Scott. I have a question about bear predation of deer. The old accepted knowledge was, accepted thought was that deer fawns didn't have any odor or something which protected them when they were very young. And now I hear stories that bears predation of fawns is very high because they can smell these fawns, and that did sound quite right to me. But I know on our hunting area west of Pittsville, where we've only had any kind of a bear population in the last few years, in fact, we have 5 of them on our camera out there this year, including and plus a couple of fawns. But I'm wondering if that's true and if the herd reduction has any significant effect from bear predation.
Hmm. Well, first of all, it is very true. Bears are very effective predators on fawns. So a lot of fawns, relatively speaking, are taken by bears. But as far as fawn predation is concerned, regardless of the predator, the issue there is it's a very short window of opportunity when the fawns are vulnerable. So it's kind of a swamping effect that lots of does drop fawns at about the same time. And yes, some are taken by bears, coyotes, bobcats, assorted other things. But bears are a factor. How much of a factor in a given area? You know, there's a lot of variability across the state. There are places where bears are up and deer are down. There are places where bears are down and deer are up. There's places where they're both up. So it's hard to put a finger on just what effect they may be having. But I'm sure there are local areas where any of these predators are particularly common where hunters might notice an effect. And there's not a great deal that can be done about it. It's part of the natural scheme of things, but it's also one of those leaks in the bucket as far as deer numbers, along with highway mortality, predation, and a whole host of other things that take deer out of the population, even though we fully acknowledge that hunting mortality is the big take. Yeah. As far as the population, there are lots of other things that remove additional animals.
Thanks, Dave, for calling. I appreciate it. I want to give Scott and Nina a chance to join in. Scott, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, let me take you off speaker. Hey, thank you. You there yet?
Yes,
we're here.
We lost him. I think he's in the car, but I have a question.
Still got the question, which is...
What's the possibility of expanding the turkey season for archery? Well, actually, you can already hunt with a bow.
I'm not sure too bad we lost Scott, because I'm not sure what specifically he was after, but you can hunt with a bow, and lots of people do.
And I know some people have been pretty successful with a bow.
Yes. So I think the opportunity is already there. If he's looking for a separate or expanded season for bow hunting only, I don't think that's probably likely, because it's already, you know, runs from September into at least around us here until the holidays. So
yeah.
I think it's about as liberal as it can be in terms of time. And if you want to use a bow, that's your choice.
Yep, absolutely. If you're bow hunting and you have a fall turkey permit, You could double down. There you go. Tracy in Wauwatosa, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have nothing against hunting, but I'm wondering, when a wolf is hunted or trapped, if it's the alpha male that's killed, I'm assuming that would ruin the whole pack or the hierarchy, but wouldn't you also be destroying, like, you know, the future, a strong genetic line, if it's usually the alpha male that's hunted or trapped? And I don't know if that's usually the case, but I'm assuming if they're out front or the one that's, you know, investigating things, they're going to be the ones that are hunted. So if it's always the alpha male, wouldn't that be ruining the whole pack then?
Yeah, okay, well, good question.
Well, you're right on one count and not quite there on the other one. The notion that perhaps the alpha male would be the most desirable animal, is the biggest or whatever, may be the case, but not usually the animal that's taken. The majority of the harvest that's there, or the animals that have been killed, whether trapped or hunted, have actually been younger animals, particularly males. But you are right in the fact that if an alpha male is removed from the pack, there's certainly a rearrangement and disruption. It doesn't necessarily mean the pack is all going to perish or scatter around the countryside, but there would be a realignment depending on the strength and size of the pack. Wisconsin packs are quite small relative to some other parts of the countryside. So I would defer to any of our many wolf experts around the state to further comment on that. But the reality is, in terms of the number of animals taken, there aren't very many alpha males in that mix.
Mm-hmm. And we have some extra, you know, and we have some folks who are wolf experts within the DNR. If they happen to be Adrian and others, if you happen to be listening, call in and let's hear from you.
A week ago Saturday night, I was at Adrian's retirement party.
So
we can no longer necessarily, hopefully he's out traveling and having a good time. We can no longer necessarily count on his expertise in the office, although he still certainly knows about these kinds of things.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Tracy, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate it. Doug in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Larry and Scott. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was kayaking on Lake Superior about a month ago, early in the morning, and on a dock right nearby, I was about 50 feet from the dock, there were half a dozen Canadian geese just sitting, like, been nesting on the dock. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw at the top of the guy's stairwell a flash, and a fox trotted down the stairs within a foot, a red fox trotted within a foot of the six geese. And they just looked at each other and didn't do anything. The fox went out to the end of the pier, sniffed around, came back, and made another contact within a foot of the six geese that didn't do anything. And the fox didn't do anything, to kind of sniff each other. And up the stairs, the fox went. And then the geese went into the lake and joined another half a dozen geese. And there were 12 of them. And the fox came down on a log another foot or two within the geese, and they were just sort of like talking with each other. I've talked with DNR people, and nobody seems to know what that was about. I actually have a photograph of the fox on the log with the geese next to it, but I couldn't get my wits about me when I saw that happening on the dock.
Oh, man, I tell you what, if you can post that up on our Facebook page, I'd love to see that.
Okay.
It's just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can post the photo there. We'd love to see it. But Scott, what about that? It's something I have not heard about.
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, those animals may have had some prior experience with each other, so that the geese didn't view the fox as much of a threat. And to an adult goose just sitting there minding its own business, had the fox decided to try and snag one, there would have been quite a commotion. So it doesn't necessarily surprise me. The other thing that is curious about waterfowl, particularly ducks, but also geese, they're attracted to dogs or members of the dog family. So you remember the term tolling dogs, a type of waterfowl hunting where a particular breed of dog is used or sent out to jump around on the shoreline and walk around, and ducks and geese will actually swim from further out on the lake or in deeper water, swim in to see what's going on. And it literally attracted them like decoys for hunting purposes. So, and when I'm exercising, or was exercising, both of our labs when the old one was still alive, throwing dummies in the water in some of the local ponds that were filled with geese, before you knew it, I mean, several hundred geese had started creeping toward us, not away, but toward us to see what the dog was up to, and we'd get pretty close. So that doesn't surprise me a great deal. Had there been goslings involved or a nest, the behavior of everybody might have been a little different, but
yeah,
I think they had come to grips with each other.
And if you've seen a mad goose, I mean, you know, if that fox had come and gone, you know, half a dozen geese could get meter running the other direction.
Right.
I can tell you that for sure. But Doug, I hope you'll post that photo. And here we're kind of losing him too. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. And let's see if we got, trying to get Dan Small on. I can't get him on.
Is he out there somewhere?
He's there. He's there somewhere. Hold on, Dan. We'll get you out in a minute here. For some reason, I'm just not able to do it. There. Got him. Hi, Dan. Are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, all right.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Dan.
And you've got a great television program coming up pretty quickly. Tell us about it.
Well, it's the annual Deer Hunt Wisconsin, and we tag the year, so Deer Hunt Wisconsin 2014. We've done it this will be the 23rd season. We work in conjunction with the DNR, and it's an hour-long show that airs first on public TV and that's going to be tomorrow night at 9 o'clock. And then next week there's a whole slew of airings on Fox Sports Wisconsin and Fox Sports North, and also on Fox 47 in Madison. So I won't try to list all those because that'll confuse everybody, but my website has a list of all the times and various stations, and that's dansmalloutdoors.com. But it's an hour-long special that this year is looking at the deer hunting regulations changes that came out of the deer trustee report that you and Scott were talking about just a few minutes ago.
Yeah, and there are lots of changes.
There are. And, you know, the overriding message here from Kevin Wallenfang and others, Kathy Stepp is featured in the show as well, is that the rules have changed, but the tradition of hunting remains. And the changes, if you look at the changes in your specific area rather than try to, you know, grasp the whole statewide picture, you'll do just fine. So if you hunt in Bayfield County, all you need to know really is no antlerless tags this year. If you hunt down in the farmland zone, there are changes to the special December antlerless season and the holiday season, depending on whether you're in the central or the southern farmland zone. And those are all detailed in the show and also, of course, in the regulations booklet.
Well, I haven't seen every one of your shows, Dan, but I've seen a whole pile of them, and they're always entertaining as well as informative. They're really fun to watch.
Well, we try to mix information with entertainment, you know, to keep people interested. And we've got lots of great footage of deer, including some bucks sparring and some successful hunters with their first deer. In the public version, we talked to several people about the Cherish Wisconsin Outdoors program. And we also hear, we talked to Jimmy Spataro, who has the world record typical whitetail with a crossbow that he took in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, practically in his backyard. And lots of, you know, interesting stories like that.
Well, it's going to be a lot of fun. And again, tomorrow night, right? 9 o'clock?
Tomorrow night, yes. Milwaukee Public TV airs it at 9 tomorrow night on the flagship channel. The Wisconsin Public TV digital channel airs it at 9. So that's on the 21.2 and so on, not the flagship channel. And then WDSE up in Duluth Superior, so the whole Douglas County, Bayfield County, Ashland County area can watch it on the 8.2 Second Chance channel. We just got that cleared yesterday. So those are the three airings, all at 9 tomorrow night, pretty much statewide on public if you can get public TV. And then Milwaukee Public TV will repeat it at 9 a.m. on Saturday, this Saturday the 8th.
And Dan, what's your web address so people want to go and see on the Fox stations and so forth?
Yep, dansmalloutdoors.com.
Dansmalloutdoors.com.
Yep, we also have a YouTube page, the Deer Hunt Wisconsin YouTube page. You can see promos of the show. You can't watch it yet until it airs tomorrow night, and after that we'll flip a switch and people can watch it right there online if they want segments or the entire show.
Thanks. Dan, thank you so much for joining in. I know it's going to be a great show. We'll be tuning in.
Good. And I'll be on Joy Cardine's show tomorrow morning at 6 to talk about more details on this, but I just wanted to give your listeners a heads up because I don't know if everybody gets up at 6.
Thanks, Dan.
I know
Dan.
You and I do.
Yeah, well, that's good. So for more details, certainly on the hunt and on the show, Dan Small is going to be on Joyce Pro program tomorrow morning at 6. Again, thanks, Dan. Appreciate it very much. He does a great job, doesn't he, Scott?
He does. It's a great show, and it's just one of those things that, at least in my case, it kind of gets you pumped up to, oh, the deer season's coming up and all the traditions are restored and whatnot. But if I'm up at 6 tomorrow morning, I'll be sitting in my pop-up blind. So we'll see what happens.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Pleasure to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to me, Larry Mueller, and Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist extraordinaire, as we talk about the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin and sometimes beyond. So, questions, join in at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our page. I'd love to hear from you. And if you've got a photo, we were talking about photos earlier, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. If you get a good wildlife photo, I love to see, and I hope you'll post them. John in Green Bay has a question, Scott. Hi, John.
Hi. That was a lot of information in a short period of time. I forgot what I was going to ask you. Brown fox. I've lived in Wisconsin most of my life in rustic areas, and I thought I was up on the animals of Wisconsin. And up until about a month ago, I have never heard or seen a brown fox. According to my hunter friends, that's what I've seen. Comes to my deck and drinks my water at night. Occasionally I get red fox, I get a gray fox once in a while. I have never seen a brown fox. Is that a common fox in Wisconsin?
Well, not only is it not a common fox, there is no such thing as a brown fox.
Well, that's why I'm calling.
I mean, we have our two.
Like a fox. Yeah. Looks exactly like a fox.
Oh, it's probably a fox, but it may not be. It's something other than a brown fox. Let's put it that way.
Well, we have two fox. Gray fox, which is more of a woodland animal. Red fox, which is woodlands and parks.
I haven't been in my backyard on occasion.
Yeah, and they're beautiful animals. They'll even be in the city or using someone's deck, just like you're describing. Red fox come in a number of different color phases, so it's possible that you have one that's a little bit of an aberration. Typical color phases are silver fox, cross fox, and so on. But as I say, just like gray squirrels that come in a variety of colors, you could have one that's in a little bit of an aberration. But I'm guessing what you've got, well, I'm not guessing, I'm pretty sure what you've got is a red fox. Whether it looks brown or not is another matter.
Hmm. Well, what's unusual, you know, of course it's at night. Mm-hmm. My deck is lighted. And it's walking along the edge of the deck. But what's unusual about it, it looks almost like a dog. It's got like curly hair, curly brown hair. I mean, I only see it for, 20, 30 seconds, and it's gone.
Huh.
It's just been most unusual. And
you should hang out with a camera and get a shot of that or your smartphone.
Usually I'm reading or doing something else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other possibility, we were going to talk about this anyway, is that for folks who are seeing something unusual or think there's something around that they're not seeing often enough, you just can't beat these new, well, they're not even new anymore.
No.
They're widely used, but trail cameras or motion-sensitive cameras that are now readily available at relatively low cost. I mean, you can spend a lot of money for some of the fancy ones, but you don't need to. But by hanging out one of these trail cameras and using it properly, you'll pick up images of all sorts of stuff that you didn't know was creeping around out there. We're using one in the back. I live on 12 acres south of town, and my wife's taken an interest in the trail camera, and holy cow, all of a sudden, in a given night, there's just a parade of raccoons, rabbits, fox, possums, deer, and assorted other things marching up and down our trails that she walks on with the dog, and all of a sudden she says, holy cow, it's like a menagerie out there. And it is, but in the absence of the trail camera, people just don't know these things are out there. But you could easily put a camera on the deck and get some good pictures of this animal, and we could figure out exactly what it is. Fox have very straight fur, and I've never seen an aberration where they were curly.
No.
Have you seen its tail? Does it have a great big bushy tail?
Yeah, it's got a big bushy tail.
And
everything looks like a fox. It's about the size, of a regular red fox.
Hmm. Curly hair.
Curly hair is what...
Well, you got to get a picture of this, John.
What color's the tip of its tail?
Oh, that I can't tell you. I really have never seen the.
Well, it should be white.
My deck is in the way.
It should be white if it's a red fox, no matter what the base coloration is. So we're going to need a picture on this one. The curly hair is a bit strange.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm telling you, the trail cam, even if you're not someone who spends a lot of time in the woods or out of doors, put one up in your backyard, and you'll be surprised at what shows up, even in a city lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not only the wildlife, but your neighbors creeping around out there, all sorts of weird stuff. So,
oh, my goodness. Who knew? Thanks again for calling. Brian in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Brian. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just questioning about the inland trout season and whether there is any movement within the DNR to extend the season beyond September 30th. My understanding is that it ends at September 30th to accommodate the spawning, but I guess there's some debate over whether that's really necessary or not. So I'm just calling about that.
Mm-hmm. I frankly don't know what their thinking is on that. I mean, the trout regulations are undergoing some major revisions, and they're talking about, you know, new systems to simplify what had become pretty complicated regulations. As it is now with the early trout season, which I think opens March 1st, you can literally fish trout from March until 1st of October. There's not a whole lot of lengthening they can do. So I'm not sure. I suppose it would be nice to perhaps add October with some nice fall weather and whatnot, but whether there's a move afoot on that, I simply don't know. It's a little out of my turf. So,
but Brian, you know, one thing you could do, you know, we were talking earlier about the DNR survey about wildlife management, we have a link to that survey on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, but you can just go to the DNR website as well, and 10-year priorities for fish, wildlife, and habitat management in Wisconsin. And, you know, if something you want, you can put that in the survey. I'd do that. It's another possibility, another chance to get your voice heard. And there is a link to the survey on our Facebook page, so take a look there. And otherwise, we don't know. Do we, Scott?
We don't.
We don't. Terry in Lake Mills, it's your turn. Hi, Terry.
Hi, doing pretty good. Yeah, as regard to that brown fox, in the early 90s in Jefferson County here, I caught one of my traps. And then I found out that three or four other guys had gotten some all around the same time. And it was discovered that they were ranch fox that had escaped.
Hmm. Ranch raised.
Well,
ranch raised. They raise fox from white to black and every shade of color in between.
That's correct, just like mink.
Right. And they had escaped from a local fox farm.
Well,
they were all brown with a white tip on their tail. I mounted it. I thought, boy, I got the greatest thing in here. It was just a common old fox that you could have bought in the store anywhere.
Well, thanks for bringing that up. I mean, that's certainly true in the fur industry in terms of captive animals. Mink, fox, and some other species are produced in virtually every color you can think of, and they do get away occasionally. So, although that was a number of years ago,
perhaps
history has repeated itself.
Yeah, could be. Thanks, Terry. Appreciate the call. Luann in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Luann.
Hi. My husband took advantage of the nice weather on November 1st and went out to Bayshore Park to throw a hook in the water. And he says that an otter popped up, looked at him, watched him fish, and then went away. Now, he said he'd never seen, he knows otters, he goes to the Quetico and all that, but he says he'd never seen one in the Bay of Green Bay. Is that an unusual sighting?
Well, I mean, it's always somewhat unusual to see an otter, but they're very charismatic, pretty, fun animals to observe. They're also curious. Otter may have viewed him as a little competition for the local fish population, who knows, but nevertheless, they're widely distributed in Wisconsin and
including Green Bay,
including Green Bay and the ponds around downtown Madison and virtually everywhere else. An otter could pop up wherever there's water.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks, Luann. Thanks a lot for calling. Other people may have wondered that as well. And guess what? We have some open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Linda in Pewaukee, We turn to you next. Hi, Linda. Thank you for calling.
Hi. You know, I completely get why it's not a good idea to feed wild animals, and I understand it's discouraged, if not prohibited. I was just wondering if you could explain to me the difference between feeding wild animals for fun and recreation and feeding wild animals to hunt them, which I understand is not prohibited. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is prohibited.
Well, it's certainly regulated, and it depends a little bit on where you are. But you've opened a can of worms here, Linda, because it's a fine line between feeding. When most people think about feeding wildlife, the first thing that comes to mind is bird
feeders.
And, you know, there are gazillions of bird feeders. Most everybody seems to have a bird feeder, and that's well accepted, perfectly legal. And the birds seem happy, the owners seem happy, everything's cool. Generally speaking, feeding mammals of any kind starts with all sorts of problems, for lack of a better term. You start attracting squirrels or raccoons or possums or whatever around the house, you're just encouraging other problems. Animals getting into the soffits, the chimney, underneath the sill plate, whatever. So generally speaking, people like me who have worked with the public through University Extension, try to discourage feeding mammals. When you start to get up to game animals, then feeding deer, for example, or feeding turkeys in the Northwoods has been largely a way of life for many years. And there are even, it's diminished, but there were restaurants and other public facilities that kept deer feeders out to attract the animals for their clients to view.
And have lights on and have big windows to look at while you're eating.
It was and remains in some areas a big deal, and wildlife feed is stacked up outside just about every grocery store and convenience store in the Northwoods and even down here in the southern part of the state now. The feeding part is regulated primarily from the standpoint of disease management. It's discouraged where it's not illegal, and in areas where chronic wasting disease, for example, affects the deer herd, and in counties adjacent to where a chronic wasting disease positive animal has been identified, there's a ban on feeding. In other areas where the disease implications are not the determining factor, there are limitations on how much bait can be put, food or bait can be put out. Now, the additional fine line becomes, all right, what's the difference between feeding and baiting?
Yeah.
I mean, essentially, if you're putting out a 5-gallon bucket of corn in the woods in front of your deer stand, yes, you're attempting to bait that animal in such that it can be hunted or potentially harvested or killed. But the animal is looking at it as free food. So you're feeding, you're also baiting. In the case of bear baiting, that too is regulated in terms of quantities and so forth. But the two primary means of harvesting bears is either baiting or pursuing them with packs of hounds. And that's the way most bears are taken in most parts of the country. And then if you want to compound things further, there are people who are anxious about this notion of planting food plots to attract deer or other mm-hmm. wildlife, feeling, well, what's mm-hmm. the difference between planting a quarter of an acre of some desirable food like corn and just dumping the corn out on the landscape? And this can get very complicated. And there are strong emotions involved, but that's why I said you kind of opened a can of worms. But does that sort of answer your question? It's not a free-for-all out there, I guess, Linda, is the real issue. There are regulations that prohibit, whether you want to call it feeding or call it baiting, it is illegal in some areas because of disease considerations. In other areas, it's regulated in terms of quantity, but what you call it is kind of a toss up.
Andy and Cudahy, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm rather confused this year with all the private versus public lands per county, and I have a couple questions. I'm not sure what I would really apply for. Number one, if I was going to hunt on forest cropland privately owned, 40s and 80s, by mm-hmm. private individuals. If I were to apply, would I apply for a public permit or a private permit for that land?
No, if you're hunting on private land, then it's a private land permit. If you're hunting on public land, like county forest, national forest, DNR wildlife management area, then that's a public land permit.
Okay. Same thing then, if you were to ask a farmer for permission to hunt on his land, you would ask then for a private deer permit for that county.
Correct.
And the last one, federal land. I hunt the bombing range in Juneau County, and that's federal land. So what is that? Is that considered also private?
Well, that there are some gray areas, and I've been inquiring about this myself, but the issue is there are public lands that are managed as if they were private. In other words, access is tightly controlled or whatever. And in that case, I was told, and I would urge you to question someone at the agency or the warden responsible for the area where you're going to be hunting, that there are public properties that are managed or treated like private land, and therefore you would need the private land permit.
Mm-hmm. And the state park, if you were to hunt in one of them, that would also be considered then public land.
Correct.
Yep.
Okay. Well, good luck to all the hunters this year, and thank you for answering my question.
Okay. All right. Good luck to you as well.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, our wildlife ecologist. Thanks a lot for listening in. Again, join in. You can email us at talk@WPR.org. You can post a photo and or question on our Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And also call at 800-642-1234. Irvin and Burnett, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. On the 19th of October, watching the football team, or while listening to the football on radio, I looked out my patio window, and at first I thought it was a crow that had landed about 150 yards from my house. And it was too big for a crow, so I put the field glasses on. It was a black pheasant rooster. Mm-hmm. He had beautiful 18-inch tail feathers on him. I watched him for about 300 yards walk along the edge of the soybean field, pick up various seeds or whatever he was looking for. And when the sun hit him just right, he had a beautiful iridescent blue to his feathers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They are beautiful. The iridescence is kind of like the head of a grackle or whatnot.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah.
They're very pretty when you have them in hand. It's a melanistic rooster pheasant, a black phase rooster pheasant, otherwise perfectly normal bird in every way other than the plumage color. And they're quite common. Well, quite common. They're widely used in the pheasant game farm industry. So they're released on shooting preserves, just like normally colored pheasants. Some of the clients find them particularly attractive. In our student learn to hunt programs, we've had students harvest them, and they're really quite an attraction because they're really strange. If you don't know what you're looking at, they really can surprise you when one appears in the black color phase. But they are pretty. They're not all that uncommon, and I'm guessing you have got some sort of a shooting preserve or game farm or something
nearby,
at least within a few miles from you, and then that bird likely originated from there.
Yeah, but you could tell he was a wild bird by the way he went along, by the way he walked, by the way he, you know, pecked various seeds and stuff.
Well, he may have, you know,
it's
may
possible.
Have been, he may have survived a winter. You never know, and in which case he'd be, a year old and probably a lot wilder than maybe a release bird. So there's that possibility too.
But in any event, you did see a black pheasant. It's not that uncommon, but they are very pretty when you do get a chance to see one.
Very pretty. Irv, thanks. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Dennis in Cambridge, what's on your mind?
Yeah, last night we were standing out on my deck. I have a bunch of acres of land behind my house, and we heard this screeching or screaming We couldn't. The closest thing I've ever heard to that was a mountain lion, and as far as I know, there's no mountain lions in Wisconsin. So we're just confused as to what it could possibly be. We have fox, we have birds of prey, coyotes. We just couldn't figure it out.
Well, and we'll offer up some alternatives for you, yeah. Dennis, but we're not going to figure it out for sure either. Given that it was last night, I'm guessing it was one of your neighbors who didn't like the election results. But in any event, while a mountain lion is not impossible, it's pretty unlikely. We have another question coming up here on the screen in a moment or two, and we'll talk a little bit about the cougar situation. But there are lots of things that might have been screaming or screeching in the woods.
Screech owl,
including several different owls. Screech owl, younger or bird of the year, barred owls make some horrendous screeching sounds. That can be a little disconcerting. Raccoons can make a variety, especially if they're squabbling with each other, a variety of screeching, growling type sounds. There's nothing more blood-curdling than a rabbit that's been grabbed by a fox or a coyote or any other predator. They scream, well, bloody murder.
Bloody murder, yeah.
I mean, it just blood-curdling screaming. So it could have been an animal that was in the process of being dispatched by another animal, and it could have been half a dozen or more different birds or mammals that can make that kind of a sound. So without even if you had a recording or could do a fantastic imitation of it, it would still be tricky to pin it down.
Yeah. You don't want my imitation of it.
Okay.
Now, does movement matter? Like, it would be like we'd be standing at the 12 o'clock and be at the 12 o'clock, and then it would move to like the 3 o'clock position.
Yeah, that is more likely. That's more likely an owl than moving around in the woods. If it lasted for quite a while and changed positions, then the screaming rabbit and so forth theory is out the window.
There you go.
Okay.
Thanks, Dennis. Thanks a lot for calling. And Jim in Heartland, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, I thought he was going to steal a little of my thunder there.
But, no, we saw you were. We wanted to preserve your opportunity to pose the question.
Yeah, I was up in the UP last year, and apparently they have a couple pairs of mating cougars up there, and there was a public service announcement that came on the radio, telling the general public what to do when they encounter a cougar and things like that. Is there any mating pairs of cougars in Wisconsin that you know of?
No. That's not to say that there isn't, but as far as I know, not only don't I know, but I don't know anyone else who has any evidence that we have any breeding activity in the state. The animals that have been, I mean, there have been cougars documented over the last handful of years, several of them, and as far as I know, they've all been, when the evidence was collected, they've all had genetic ties to populations west of us in the Dakotas. And for the most part, I think they've all been young males that are out trucking around and just passing through Wisconsin, although at any given time, there could be an animal or two in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because once in a while, won't they find deer in trees? I know they, a retired friend of mine who used to work for the DNR said they found a deer in a tree about 20 years ago.
I don't know about that. That's not one that I had heard. I think that would have attracted a bit of attention had been discovered, but
I suppose it's not impossible.
Not impossible, but I hadn't heard anything about that.
Thanks, Jim, for calling. George in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, George.
Good morning.
Morning.
Prior to a couple callers back, you had a call in regard to bear predation, in regard to deer.
Mm-hmm.
Could you please talk a little bit more about wolf predation? Some years ago, I read a healthy wolf would take somewhere upwards 20 to 25 deer. Obviously, wolf raised such great emotions. Could you just, I guess, address that a little bit more as far as what's good current knowledge in regard to that, and how many roughly a healthy deer or a healthy wolf will take?
In a year. Okay.
So this is sort of like the how much wood could a woodchuck...
Yeah.
Actually, the party line in terms of what's in the literature for if a wolf, if a healthy adult wolf ate deer and nothing but deer over the course of a year, I've seen estimates from a low of 17 to a high of 24 or 25 deer that would sustain that wolf for the year. So use a nice round figure of 20 because it's easy mm-hmm. to multiply. First of all, they eat lots of other things other than deer. And some of the deer they eat is actually carrion from road kills, gut piles after the hunting season, an assortment of other things. So the average wolf probably doesn't account for 20 deer. But if you just want to go theoretically, so you come up with a round population estimate, average it over the course of a year of 1,000 wolves, it's something less than that, and 20 deer per wolf, you come out with a maximum of 20,000 deer. Wolves are far less abundant than bears, bobcats, coyotes, and all the other predators on deer. So while wolves certainly do eat deer, some people would say a lot of deer, some people would argue that, I don't think there's much question that in a local area where there's an active pack or two, a hunter or landowner might detect a change in deer numbers because of wolf activity. But in the bigger scheme of things, in terms of the deer herd, while wolf predation is a piece of the puzzle, it's not the only one, and it's not the biggest one.
Yeah.
Does that get at what you were interested in, George?
Yes. I've lived all over. I lived in Alaska, and I've always lived in wolf country, and I've had many encounters, and I have found wolves to be about as non-threatening as you can get. And it's always interesting to me that how people can get so emotional in regard to wolves. But yes, I won't take any more of your time. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. I think one of the as you talked about local areas, if you, for example, we have a pack of wolves that a couple of years ago moved into our deer hunting area, and I'm not so sure that they kill all the deer. They decide to move elsewhere.
Let's go somewhere else, guys.
Yes. I honestly think that's more the case on sort of a local situation for people. And Jamie in Colfax, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. How you guys doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
So my question is about a moose that was sighted up. I live in Dunn County, Eau Claire, Menominee area.
Yep.
And it was, like, really publicized all over Facebook and the news and stuff. And I haven't heard nothing since then. And it was heading south, apparently, and I just haven't heard much after that if it was still being tracked or...
It's a good question. And, you're right, Jamie. There was a lot of information over maybe a week's period, and then it sort of just all went away. Scott,
I've heard nothing about that, and I monitor outdoor news and some of the other things that keep up with current events, and I've not seen anything lately, so I don't know what happened.
This was
to the
a
animal.
Young, yeah, this was a young bull.
Well, they can cover a lot of ground, especially this time of year. So I assume, however, one would assume that if it moved on, that it's caused a similar stir wherever it ended up, unless it ended up.
Unless it turned around and headed north.
or unless it met with some unfortunate end, which is also possible.
Yeah, that's true. But if Jamie, stay listening, because if somebody else has more information on the moose, I'm sure that person will call in. So stay with us. Thanks for calling. Rod in Weyerhaeuser. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you, Larry. Another good program. I just wanted to comment. The other day I heard geese, and I looked up, they were not extremely high, but fairly high, you know. And I believe they were the snow geese, white, you know, all white.
Yep.
The only thing is, it was odd because they were heading south, and on the left, the west wing, about three back or four back, there was one that was entirely black. And I don't know, my dad said one time he seen a flock of geese, and he said there was one duck. And he said it was flopping its wings to beat the bandit. You know, I suppose it was trying to keep up, you know. But anyhow, I was just wondering what you thought that was. And I had one other question. There'd been another report of a cougar hanging around here. And, of course, we got one big wolf they know on camera. If there was a pack of two or three wolves, do you think that they would even dare attempt to try a cougar?
All right. Would they fight?
I don't know that there's any reason to suspect that. I think they'd stay out of each other's way, actually.
Probably.
So I don't think that's something we need to be. Plus, in the bigger scheme of things, over the landscape the size of Wisconsin, with a handful of cougars and not all that many wolves, the chance of a chance encounter is pretty slim. As far as the geese are concerned, you see a flock of geese going over. If they were all white, I assume they had at least black wingtips, so that we'd know they're snow geese. But in any event, what was with them? I don't know. It could have been just about. Was it this? Are you still there, Rod?
Was about three back.
Was it the same size as the snow geese?
It looked pretty much the same size.
Yeah. Okay.
Well. You know, at a distance, I suppose the odd, I don't mean odd in the sense of abnormal, but odd in the sense of flying with snow geese, depending on the
one Canada, maybe?
Depending on the lighting conditions, one Canada of similar size would have certainly looked like a dark bird in the flock of lighter birds. That's maybe the most likely alternative.
Mm-hmm.
There are no ducks that would approach the size of a snow goose, so that's not the issue.
I'm betting on Canada goose.
That would be the most likely thing, Rod, but, you know,
there you go.
Who knows at this point?
We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Scott Craven. Stay with us. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Lucky we live in Wisconsin with all the wonderful wildlife, and lucky to have Scott Craven, our wildlife ecologist, come by every so often to talk with us about those wildlife. You have a question about them, the number is 1-800-642-1234. If you got a photo, go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo there. You can also post a question. We'd love to hear from you. As a matter of fact, Scott, Bill on Facebook says, deer hunters on private lands under the MFL open program need a public land tag this year.
Well, that's the managed forest law, and it's a tax break for private landowners that if they agree to open their land for access, they get a tax break.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a forestry initiative. That makes some sense, but all I'm going to say on the matter is that it supports what Dan Small said a while back, that it is imperative that you know, you being a deer hunter, any deer hunter has to know where they're going to hunt and what the rules are that are in place for that county property or what have you, given all the changes going into effect this year. If you hunt in multiple places, it becomes just that much more complicated. This makes some sense, but I was under the impression that a landowner could still limit the number of people. Even in an open, it's not just a free-for-all,
yeah.
Which means there's still some private control. So this is one of those things where you better clear it up with the local people before you hit the woods.
Yeah, it's better to do it now than try to do it the night before the season
right.
opens. Dennis in Montello, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, I'm just wondering if the increase in the wolf population and distribution has had any effect on coyote populations and distribution.
They don't like each other.
They don't like each other. Members of the dog family don't play well together, so that wolves will displace or move coyotes around, and coyotes will displace or move fox around. So their home ranges or territories tend to be kind of a volatile mix of polygons on the landscape that mm-hmm. There are no wolves over here, so the coyotes are doing okay, but the fox may be squeezed into the edge of the urban areas or what have you. So there is some realignment of the distribution of those dog family predators because of interactions between the three species.
Yep.
Yes.
There you go. Thanks, Dennis. Jeff in Jackson, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
In the 80s, I harvested a fox that had short kind of curlyish hair and was kind of on the brownish. It actually looked like it didn't have much for long guard hair. An old trapper that I knew at that time told me it was a Richardson. That genetically, that's a fox that's somewhere in the bloodline. It loses some of its longer guard hair and has a little more of a kind of a matte coverage on its fur. So that was one of the possibilities. And I was going to point out that the possums and a lot of the other animals that didn't make it through the winter, very noticeable this year.
Yeah.
Okay, as far as the Richardson fox is concerned, I've excuse me, I've not heard that term, and there are, mm-hmm. you know, there are issues related to skin mites and a whole host of things that change an animal's fur pattern, the loss of guard hair, and I'm trying to remember there is a term. It's a Samson fox.
Oh, and Samson.
That's similar. That's very similar to Richardson.
I have heard that term, and that's a guard hair problem. So there are some – these are terms that describe a pelage condition or disease or parasite condition that affects the pelage or fur of the animal, not a kind of a fox. The reality is that, you know, as I said, as far as native fox in Wisconsin, we have red fox and gray fox. Yep. There's some coat color variation, and then there are issues like these kinds of conditions that affect individual animals. That may well be what he saw, but I'm hoping he'll send us a picture before too long.
Yeah, I'd sure like to see one. And then what about Jeff's comments about the winter and its effect, last winter and its effect on wildlife?
Well, it was a brutal winter, no question about it. Some things that people thought would really get hammered, the deer herd came through it reasonably well, except in the extreme north. Turkeys seemed to come through pretty well, but certainly I would expect something as variable as possum populations. I'm sure the possums took it pretty hard last winter, and I guess now that I think about it, I've not seen a road-killed possum for some time, and that's usually my index to how the possum population
is
doing. And I haven't seen a possum on the trail camera either, but certainly there are a few animals like that that are really right on the ragged edge of the northern edge of their distribution, and the winter was probably pretty hard on them.
Brad emailed us a photo of two deer, one with very short or cropped ears. He's wondering what would have caused that. He says the picture was taken in the Barnes area, which is where we have a cabin, in the barn, right in Barnes, is a mountain town of Barnes, this past spring. And we had a look at that photo. And, you know, it's so many different ways.
I mean, I can think of a number of mechanical issues that might have taken off those ear tips. It could have been. My guess is that it's something that had happened to that animal. If it's not a genetic condition, and it's not something I've seen before, if it's not a genetic condition, it could have easily been something mechanical at when the animal was a fawn, ranging from damage from farm equipment, which happens, frostbite or some other problem with an early drop fawn, maybe a predator, but that seems like a little bit of an outside edge. But, you know, we could probably come up with other things as well. But at this point, there's no obvious explanation that I'm aware of, and everything else
healthy.
Is speculation. The deer looked fine, other than having short ears.
Earlier, a caller asked about the moose seen in his area a few weeks ago. Well, we got a Facebook comment from Bill, who says that the moose was last seen, or at least reported, in Wilson Township in Eau Claire County two nights ago. So he's still out there wandering around.
Still out there looking around. Yeah.
There we go. And thanks a lot for sending that note in on our Facebook page, Bill. Appreciate it. Beth in Lake Geneva, thanks
Hello.
For calling. Hi.
Oh, absolutely. Hi. I love it when Scott is on. My question is, we've had lots of cardinals that are bird feeders for years and years and years, and all of a sudden the population is down to virtually nothing. And I was wondering if you've noticed any change in population. I will say we've had a lot of turkeys. I don't know if those would deter the ground feeding cardinals.
Nah,
probably not. Beth, usually when something like this happens at with a common feeder bird, the explanation is more environmental than catastrophic. This came up in my own yard around the feeding station this morning. I happened to look out the kitchen window, and there was a nice red male cardinal on the garden fence. And I thought to myself, well, wait a minute now. That's the first cardinal I've seen in the last few weeks. So I've got tons of goldfinches and house finches and assorted other things, but the cardinals have all but disappeared, and they're usually the last birds that come in the evening and are sometimes still there even when it's getting dark. But I'm not seeing them, and frankly, I think the most likely explanation is that at this time of year, with all of the seeds and assorted other things ripe, and with this is really a time of plenty for bird materials, bird feed materials, that the cardinals may be just doing their own thing and just aren't as dependent on the feeding stations right now as they may be once we get some colder, snowy weather and natural foods are depleted. I'm guessing that we're both going to see our cardinals back again when that happens.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
Well, I mean, we may, in 2 months when I'm on again, we may be saying, hey, what happened to the cardinals? They didn't come back, in which case we'll do a little more exploration. But at least since you brought up that subject and we're running short of time, I did just want to point out to our bird feeding listeners.
Oh, yes, some good sales.
There have been a lot of good sales on bird seed just the last couple of weeks. Especially on black oil sunflower. I remember talking on the program a couple of years ago when there was a lot of other demand on oil sunflower. I can remember being up in the neighborhood of $30 a bag.
Yeah.
Well, on most of the sales I'm seeing now, it's back down around $17.99 for a 50-pound bag of black oil seed, which is not that far removed from the lows of 10 or 12 years ago when they were $12 or $13. So this is a really good time to stock up on your bird seed for the winter, and lots of places are advertising similar sales. So
good to know. Do we have time for one other quick question?
Sure.
Okay, hiking during deer hunting season in the state parks, is it okay?
I'd wear blaze orange.
I'd certainly get you can get an inexpensive blaze orange vest and a warm hat for just a few bucks, and that's just a common sense safety concern.
Okay,
you can certainly do it, and I think in blaze orange
a problem.
You should be okay.
Good, great.
All right, thanks
so much.
Yeah, thanks, Beth. Appreciate the call. And you can get something that fits right over a normal jacket for a couple of bucks. That's really bright. John in Rhinelander. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. Scott actually just touched on a question that I had pertaining to the feed that we feed, wild animals, deer, turkeys, whatever, and including birds. I'm curious, has there been any research done at all about the toxicity, GMO, Roundup Ready type feeds that we're feeding the animals? And I will take your comments off air.
All right. I don't think there's been anything, or at least in my memory, but Scott, obviously you would know better than me.
Well, there's quite a bit of material in the literature about the impacts of not necessarily the toxicity, but just the change. Deer is a ruminant.
Oh,
and
sure.
On a steady,
yes.
Steady diet of corn. Yeah. It affects their gut fauna, and it can make it difficult for them to switch back to a normal diet of browse and so forth and cause some digestive problems. So that's one element. There's some anecdotal evidence, and it may be in the literature. I think a good literature search or Google search would turn this up, that some of the things that, especially the sugary products that are being used for bear feeding, baiting kind of thing, may not be the best nutritionally for bears if they're really hitting the baits for a long period of time. That's something somebody could check on. That's, as I said, anecdotal rather than anything I can cite chapter and verse on. And then, of course, there's also evidence in the literature, just the things that we're putting in to the water supply or foodstuffs by way of pharmaceuticals that can affect especially things that are using or living in or near the water that are also some problems for reproductive parameters and nutrition and so forth. So there are plenty of effects out there, but overall, if it was deer the caller was most concerned about, for the most part, with the exception of disease issues like CWD and a couple others, the deer herd is pretty healthy for the most part.
Al in Kakana, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call.
Hi, I was wondering if you had any knowledge of how the deer rut's doing compared to normal years. I'm thinking it's behind just from what I've seen watching, but if he has any insight on that, that'd be great.
Well, the only insight I can give you is either what I see in some of the online reports or what I've seen in the woods myself. And I'll tell you what, about last Wednesday, about a week ago, things went
at least in
southwestern Wisconsin, where I spend most of my time in the woods, things really kicked in over the course of about 48 hours from not so many scrapes, not so many rubs. All of a sudden, it just seemed like they were everywhere. And on my trail camera in the backyard, I've been watching an eight-pointer and a spike that wanders around the trails through our property. And was it yesterday or the day before? My wife bumped into both of them face-to-face on the trails at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and one at 8 o'clock in the morning while she was walking our dog. So there's lots of activity right now. So I don't know that we're at the peak of rut yet, and it's only been going on down here for maybe a week or a little more, but it's certainly on.
Steve in Neillsville, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. My question is, have you ever heard of German Shepherds being crossbred with wolves and then released into the wild? I mean, I asked this because I purchased a dog, and I think he may be half wolf and half shepherd.
Well, there's been a lot of controversy ever since wolves made their comeback in Wisconsin a couple decades ago about the management issues posed by wolf-dog hybrids that were occasionally being bred and marketed. I don't know why anybody would want a wolf-dog hybrid.
Yeah.
That kind of thing baffles me, just like keeping exotic animals as pets. But nevertheless, it was done. It has been done. It can be done. Intentionally released into the wild, I don't know why anybody would do that either. And that's not good for wolves or dogs or anything else. So I guess what you're suggesting is possible, but I just haven't. It seems like there was a big flurry of interest in that and concern about it years ago, but it seems like that's been kind of quiet lately.
Yeah.
I haven't heard much about it.
Steve thinks he may have one, and there's probably a genetic test that could be done to determine that.
I think that's something where you should go through your vet.
Yeah.
And see what they could do for a blood test that might help you out.
Yeah, I think I'd go to the vet for sure. I would not want to own. I'm with you. I don't know why anybody would want to own that kind of animal. Marion Washburn, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to go back to the feeding baiting issue, just with two quick questions.
Sure.
I'm wondering if either of these things are part of the discussion in the hunting and DNR community. Over the last 10 years, I've run across articles about research done about how the dental health of bear, has been affected in some areas by the 50-gallon drums of frosting and cookie dough and such that are used for baiting.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also run across writing research about the effect of corn grain baiting on deer, which are essentially ruminants and, like cows, are not ideally mm-hmm. set up to their digestive systems to be dealing with quantities of grain.
Well, a previous caller asked basically that exact question, Mary, just a couple minutes ago, and we did bring up the fact that ruminants like deer can be affected. Their gut fauna can be affected by a steady diet of corn, for example, which can make it somewhat difficult for them to switch back and forth among dietary types. And as far as the sugary materials that are often used for bear baiting, we talked about the anecdotal evidence that I wasn't talking necessarily about dental problems, although that certainly might be an issue, but some other digestive or potentially physiological effects of that much sugar. in the diet of a bear if they're hitting bait stations for an extensive period. So, yes, the short answer to your question is there is some dialogue going on about that kind of thing, but at least for now, it's not been a big factor in the ongoing debate over whether feeding and baiting should be more tightly regulated or banned than they are.
Okay, there we go. Thank you, Mary. I want to give Wayne in West Dallas a chance as we nearer the end of the show. Wayne, hi.
Hi, good morning. You mentioned before a guy called in about wearing blaze orange when he's out in the woods. And what about bright yellow? I have a couple of bright yellow light weather jackets that I wear when I'm biking and hiking if it's, you know, damp out. You think that's acceptable?
That would be fine. You can wear hot pink if you want. The point is you just want to be visible. The deer hunters...
You don't want to look like a deer.
No, the deer hunters are constrained by legal requirements for a certain amount of blaze orange that they have to wear. And blaze orange has been determined to be highly visible. So while that's best,
fluorescent,
in my opinion,
I know that
least,
fluorescent yellow, it's
that,
pretty...
That safety bright. Yellow that, you know, highway workers and so forth wear, or anything else in a fluorescent color, or some combination
pink.
Of the two so that you look like a painted bunting out there in the woods. Bottom line is you want to be seen, and whatever you feel most comfortable in for visibility, you're not constrained by the same laws that affect hunters.
Mountain, Wisconsin, and I know people give me a wide berth on their cars.
Yep.
Yeah, there you go. Gene in Salem, hi.
Hello.
Do you have a quick question for us?
Yes, we used to put blaze orange on our dog when we walked in the woods.
Sure.
That's also a good idea.
Right, but for several years we used to hear a chirp at night, and I knew all the birds were sleeping, and finally we saw a little squirrel with a white belly climbing on the tree, and it looked like a little flying squirrel. Could that have been?
Certainly. There
yeah,
are flying. There are flying squirrels throughout the state. Southern flying squirrels, which are kind of smallish, northern flying squirrels, which are a little bigger. And they're beautiful little animals. They have a white belly and, of course, the membrane that stretches out between their legs so they can glide, and a nice bushy tail and great big eyes because they're strictly nocturnal. They are out at night. That's when you'd see one. That's when they come to people's feeders. And, yes, it's certainly quite possible that you saw one.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And, Scott, there's so many things, the tribal hunting issues we didn't get into with this.
Well, people can read up on that. There's a fair bit of interest in the fact that this notion of night deer hunting off-reservation that was going to go into effect this year has been tabled for some legal or technical clarifications.
Swans?
The tribes are beginning a 2-month swan hunt that started last, was it Saturday?
Yeah.
Anyway, the 1st of November. So swans are being hunted in Minnesota and Wisconsin and so forth. That's a new thing. And trumpeter swans can be taken, although the harvest is limited. And that's the kind of thing that I think people wonder about. Gee, didn't we just spend a lot of human capital and money to restore these animals? And, you know, they're now being hunted again, kind of the wolf mindset. So people might want to check into that kind of thing.
And we're out of time.
We didn't even talk about our holiday gift-giving ideas. Oh, well. Okay, so it goes.
So it goes. Scott, we'll see you in January.
Yep, next year.
Next year. You have a great month of November and December, and we'll look forward to your next visit for sure. And just tomorrow, talk about how baby boomers and others can stay current and competitive in this tech-savvy workforce. So lots of good things to talk about there. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.